All right, thanks. Let's go to Matthew 17, y'all. Matthew 17. So last week we discussed the transfiguration, which of course is one of the hallmarks of the Gospels. And tonight we're going to go into the story of the disciples' failures. Just a forecast of the evening. Unless we work way ahead, which never happens, we're going to leave the story of the temple tax to next week. Having had more times to simmer on that text this week, that actually fits way better with chapter 18 than it does 17. So we're going to, I think, save that text for next week, which gives us plenty of time then to discuss 14 through 23 of this chapter. As you look at the transfiguration, this is from my review on the front of the sheet. This is what we discussed last week. At the transfiguration, Jesus, of course, ascends up to the mountain and he receives glory from on high. Having talked with Moses and Elijah, the Father then pronounces, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." Peter, James, and John fall down. Jesus then comes down, no longer shining, and says, "Have no fear," and then reveals to them again that he will have to suffer many things, and through that, his kingdom will come. And this is just a quick summary of what we discussed theologically from last week. Why Moses and Elijah? Well, Moses was a prophet who received revelation from God at Sinai. Elijah was a prophet of God who received revelation from God at Sinai. Jesus Christ is the final prophet who is God's final revelation, fulfilling all that Moses and Elijah had promised. So whenever you focus on this, it's all about the revelation of God. What then did Jesus Christ reveal? Both humanity's rejection of God and God's grace to humanity. Our takeaway from last weekend was only when we are so overwhelmed by seeing God's glory will we fall on our faces to listen to him. So I want to reread this section as we enter into verse 14 tonight, because it's a remarkable, remarkable thing that Matthew is doing in this. So I want us to contextualize this. Kirby, I'm going to have you read this section again for us. Matthew 17, which I'm actually having you start in 16. Matthew 16, 28 through 17, 13. So again, Kirby, that is 16, 28 through 17, 13. Go ahead.
"Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of God coming in his kingdom." And 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as light. Behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. And Peter answered and said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were much afraid. And Jesus came to them and touched them and said, "Arise and do not be afraid." And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. And as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." And his disciples asked him, saying, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" And he answered and said, "Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he had spoken to them about John the Baptist. And when they came to the multitude, a man came up to him, falling on his knees before him, and say, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic, and he is very ill, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him." Jesus answered and said, "O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? bring him here to me. Can't go too far.
Keep going. Go through 20 or 21, depending on your translation.
I'll go. Okay, and Jesus returned him, and the demon came out of him. And the boy was cured. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "Because of the littleness of your faith. But truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, just say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible for you. But this kind does not go away except a prayer and fasting." Yeah, you said stop at 13. My bad.
No, I'm glad you know. It's perfectly fine, because that's the whole text we're talking about tonight. For us to really understand what's going on in this short but very powerful section, verse 14 down through 20 or 21, I'll talk about that in a minute. You have to contextualize this with the transfiguration. Now, it's interesting as you work back through the transfiguration to notice the identity of Jesus that is in this. Kirby, can I put you on the spot again and have you do that review of Matthew on the front of that page?
Yeah.
Can you do that first question for us again? Matthew shows that
Jesus is King.
Yes. Who has come to?
Who has come to redeem.
By?
Proclaiming the gospel.
Very good. Okay. And then our second question here. Jesus is King as he is
Son of God.
Son. Excellent. Okay. This is the key word that I want you all to notice as we get into the text tonight. You have in Matthew 16 and 17 this focus that Jesus is the Son. Okay. This has been the whole question of Matthew 12, and it's going to continue into 18. Who is Jesus? If you look back to Matthew 12, this was the question that was sent from John the Baptist. That's in 14. But in Matthew 12, rather, the question comes before them, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? And in quoting in Matthew 12, verse 17, this is to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet of Isaiah, behold my servant. Then you go back to 11, which is John the Baptist. John 11, verse 3, John sent messengers to him saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And if you all will briefly just look in your Bibles and skim through Matthew 11, Matthew 12, Matthew 13, 14, 15, 16, and then to 17. This is the question that's driven the narrative. Who is Jesus? Is Jesus really who he's claiming to be? Now, more immediately back in 16, Simon Peter gave the bold proclamation, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And yet, when you look at Matthew 17, there are two different titles that are attributed to Jesus here. First of all, Kirby, if you look at Matthew 17, verse 5, read that verse again for me, please.
While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I well pleased."
At the transfiguration, whose son do we see Jesus Christ as?
God the Father's Son.
Very good. On the one hand, we see Jesus as the Son of God. Okay? On the one hand, we see Jesus as the Son of God. But then, if you look back to the very last verse of chapter 16, I think it's verse 28. Read that for me.
"Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
Okay. And then if you look likewise to 17:12.
"But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their deeds."
And then 17:22.
"And while they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men.'"
Okay. Now, in this case, we see Jesus Furby as
the Son of Man.
The Son of Man. Now, sit with this just for a second. Whenever Jesus goes up to the mountain, the Father proclaims, "This is my Son, in whom I'm well pleased." There's one other time in Matthew that the Father has made this proclamation. What is that? "This is my beloved Son, with whom I'm well pleased."
Baptism. Please baptize.
As baptism. Chapter 3, I think it's 17 there. Chapter 3, 17 or 18, somewhere around there. The Father likewise proclaims, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I'm well pleased." And then likewise here in 17, "This is my beloved Son." Here we see clearly he is the Son of God. But there's this other title that he is the Son of Man. Now, I want to sit with this just for a second. If you notice at the Transfiguration, Kirby, I'm having you read this. Sorry, just one more time for me. I want y'all to notice, what are the attributes and the qualities that are associated with Jesus being the Son of God? 17 verses 5 and 6.
While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, who I am well pleased. Listen to him." And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were afraid.
Right. So, Kirby, whenever we read that Jesus here is the Son of God, how would you describe that sonship, the characteristics and attributes of that?
Bright. Yeah. Shining.
Yeah. The word I would use is glorious. This is the glorious nature of the Son of God. But then, you notice 16:28, one more time.
"Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing there who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
The Son of Man is going to come with his kingdom. Now, this is one of those titles of the New Testament that, like, we've now spent 2 months talking about the word Lord in our Trinity study and what all that term means. We could equally spend a few months talking about the word Son of Man and where that comes from. One of the clear places, Daniel, this comes from is
Daniel
7. Yeah, Daniel 7, verse 13, the Son of Man coming with the clouds. Matthew's going to quote that verse explicitly in Matthew 24. But Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. Also here, for him to be the Son of Man, we could think of this as which atonement theory? He's the son of Adam.
Yeah. Recapitulation.
Yeah, he's the son of Adam here. So there's a few, kind of like the term Lord in the New Testament has a few different meanings that all converge into it. That likewise is how this term is, but I'm not going to explicate that fully tonight. That'll take us down too many rabbit holes. But I just want to kind of hold these terms in tension together. And likewise, if you notice back to a bit later, notice again, chapter 17 and verse 12, Kirby.
17:12.
Yep.
"But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands."
Okay.
Brian.
Bruce, let me get you this one part, then I'll open up the floor, okay? You'll notice that here within the context of Matthew 17, I want us to notice here, the Son of God is the Son of God glorified. Okay? Here you have the Son of God glorified. But here you have the Son of Man rejected. Do you see how both of these terms are coming together in Jesus? The Son of God glorified is the Son of Man rejected. And even as you work again later to 17:22, they were gathering in Galilee. Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." Now, the way I tried to say this succinctly on the front of the page is, in Jesus Christ, we see both humanities, that shouldn't say humanities, I left off the apostrophe S. We see both humanity's rejection of God, yet God's grace to humanity. Notice this again. The Son of Man the Son of God glorified is the Son of Man rejected. Said another way, the Son of God humiliated is the Son of Man exalted. Same thing going on here in that text. Okay? Now, let me open up the floor. Bruce, get us started.
I was just going to say along that lines, you skipped over verse 9, and it was just right after the transfiguration. He said, don't tell anybody about this until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead.
Right.
So I never really thought about this a whole lot, because in my entire life as a Christian, it's all centered around Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God. That's our confession. And yet he repeatedly calls himself the Son of Man. And Heath, I appreciated what you did when you interjected the word recapitulation. I guess maybe because I haven't thought about this that much, I don't realize the significance of Jesus reinforcing the fact that he's the Son of Man.
Yeah. And what's interesting about it, Bruce, he does not, within the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, refer to himself as the Son of God repeatedly over and 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 over again. He calls himself the Son of Man. He is the true Son of Man. Now, let's just simmer on that just for a bit more. What does that mean? Well, think back to my Image of God series, humanity versus the beast. Finally, one has come from Adam who is not going to be ruled by the beast, but who is going to be the true son of Adam. What does this term mean? It means that he is the true human. He is the true son of man. And we have to recognize that these two things are coming together here. In Jesus Christ, God and humanity is brought back into union with one another. Because the Son of God humiliated is the Son of Man exalted. The Son of God glorified is the Son of Man rejected. In Jesus, you see both God's grace and its infinite glory, but you also see humanity's sin in all of its horrendous might. Both of these are revealed together. Now, to go ahead and see where this is leading, ultimately, where is this going to come to a climax? You're going to find God and humanity come together at the cross. The Son of Man will be glorified at the cross, John 12, etc. The Son of Man is rejected most fully at the cross. All of this is taking us right back to the foot of the cross. And this is important to note as we get into our narrative tonight. Other thoughts about this, y'all? The identity of Jesus, who he is. Kirby.
Just real quick. I stutter all the time, so you probably didn't catch me stutter when I first was going to answer your fill in the blank things at the beginning of the page, you know. But what I was about to say was Matthew shows that Jesus is the true Adam. You know, I was going to kind of change it, but anyway.
Yeah. I mean, totally. I mean, there's so many different identities of Christ that are revealed to us in Matthew, but they're all coming back to this idea of kingship. And really then the only one who has, I mean, this is where we were recently in our Trinity class. Jesus is the King of heaven as the Son of God. He is the King of earth as the Son of Man. These two come together. And that's actually where Daniel 7 is taking us. As I said, I'm so tempted, but I'm not going to take us down that rabbit hole tonight. But that's, I would really encourage those who want to take this down further. Read Daniel 7, read Matthew 24. They are two of the most complicated, confusing, but rewarding chapters in the whole Bible. But that's where you see the Son of Man is going to come and fulfill and restore God's rightful dominion on earth. Only Christ.
I just think it's just the marvelous part of this whole mystery that in order for God to save his creation, he had to enter into our condition. He had to become human to save us. It's amazing to think about that Jesus, like you said, walked this earth and repetitively called himself the Son of Man, and not even acknowledging, you know, his deity at first, because he wanted us to know that he came to understand our condition and heal us.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the doctrinal formulation of this, and I've mentioned this before in sermons and classes, it's interchange. God entering into humanity's situation, that humanity can enter into God's. That's what you see going on here at the Transfiguration. Other thoughts about this, y'all? Thoughts or questions? Who is Jesus?
I have a question.
Yes, Carrie.
Okay. In 17:13, it says, then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. That seems out of place. Why is that there?
Excellent question. I didn't take us down this fully last week, but I'll answer your question. Carrie, give me a few minutes to follow this down. And then if I confused you further, tell me and we'll simplify it, okay? Verse 9, as Peter, James, John, and Jesus Christ were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And the disciples asked him, then why do the scribes say that Elijah must first come? Now, for any Israelite, they would have expected the arrival of the Messiah to be ushered in by John the Baptist. Oh, not John the Baptist, by Elijah. Sorry, by Elijah. The hallmark text of the Old Testament, Isaiah 40 through 42, Malachi chapter 4, many others, but those are the two I'd probably hold up as the hallmarks. Elijah was expected to come back and prepare the way of the Lord for the Messiah to come. Elijah is even mentioned by name in Malachi 4, I think it's verses 5 and 6. Elijah will come and turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children and the children back to their fathers. Elijah would come. Now, they know this promise. Carrie, talk to you this with me. Who has Peter, James, and John just seen appear?
Moses and Elijah.
So they're thinking, oh, we've just seen Elijah. No. We've just seen Elijah. Now, I'm going to talk about this again in a little bit. Throughout Matthew, the disciples are just seen as failures. I can just imagine Jesus saying, you still don't get it. You still don't get it. He answered, Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. That's the promise of the Old Testament. But I tell you, Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then, finally, took them long enough, the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. So let me put all that together. Why did they think Elijah had to first come? Because the Old Testament prophets, 500 plus years before, had promised Elijah would come back. By name, Elijah would come back. They've just seen Elijah appear again. They're thinking, oh, now we're ready.
Yeah.
He's like, no, that's not the Elijah we're talking about.
Okay.
There was an Elijah that came, John the Baptist.
Okay.
And much as John was rejected and murdered by the authorities, so also the Son of Man would be rejected and murdered by the authorities. Yeah. And this is the irony of this. Even to this day, there are some Jewish families that when they observe Passover will set a place for Elijah at their table, waiting for Elijah to return. This is an ancient custom. I don't know exactly how old it is, but certainly even during the times of Jesus, there was an ancient custom that Elijah would have a place prepared at Passover. I mean, that's how much they were wanting Elijah to come. But still, the disciples don't get it. It's not a literal Elijah. It was a prophet like Elijah, John the Baptist, who first had to come. Yeah.
Carrie, so,
did that rabbit hole finally lead us to clarity?
Yeah, Carrie didn't get it either.
Hey, Brian, I know we're pretty harsh on the disciples. We ride them down the road a lot because so far in Matthew, he's rebuked them several times for not getting it. And he just has to flat out say, this is the answer. Well, I got to say, they got this one. he did not have to say, it is John, you guys, come on. He had to re-explain it, but once he explained it and they got it, let's give them credit. At least they're starting to catch up.
I would agree. And also the thing I would say with this is, we have to recognize whenever Matthew is talking about the disciples, he's including himself in that category. I mean, over and over and over again. I mean, we're about to read a story. Kirby's already read it for us, of the disciples lacking faith. Matthew, the writer of this book, is putting himself in that category. I mean, that takes a great deal of humility. I mean, we could talk about Matthew's not shaming himself in this, but he's humbly understanding, I needed the instruction and the wisdom of the Lord. But gracious, I followed him for 3 years and still made mistake after mistake after mistake. The Spirit had to come and lead me into all truth. Okay, well, we're 30 minutes into class and we haven't even talked through our text tonight. But I want us to note then, okay? Let's note. Matthew 17 is all about Jesus as the Son of God and the Son of Man. The Son of God glorified is the Son of Man rejected. The Son of God humiliated is the Son of Man exalted. It's all about the communion of humanity and God. And then with that, we get to chapter 17, verse 14. When they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, Lord, have mercy on my son. Lord, have mercy on my son. Immediately, if you have just listened to the story that Matthew has just told, is this merely a story about one father and one son? What's this the story of? Lord, have mercy on my son.
Sounds like it's Jesus thinking about what he's about to endure, and he's putting himself in the place of this son, whose Lord has just come, whose father, whose master has just come asking for mercy. Jesus is going to go through that same situation, asking for mercy. Mm-hmm.
Couple of levels here. He, I think, is showing us the greater one. At the Transfiguration, we see the revelation of the Son of God. God's Son in his own presence is glorified, illuminated, glorious. But then when they come down from the mountain, we see humanity and the children of what does C.S. Lewis call it? The sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. We see ourselves as we really are. Sick. Sick. And who is going to deliver us from this sickness? This, I think, is what this story is really about. Now, we know already from Matthew chapter 8 that Jesus Christ has this ability. You think back to Matthew chapter 8. This is whenever Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. It says in verse 16, that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons and cast out the spirits with the word, and he healed those who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Eric, where's that from? He took our sicknesses and bore our diseases. Isaiah 53. This is Isaiah 53 being quoted here. Whenever you then get to this narrative of a father's son who is sick, that is us, who's going to heal this child? Who's going to heal this child? We know that Jesus has this ability, but who else should have been able to heal this child? Eric?
The disciples,
yeah. If you look back to Matthew chapter 10, verse 1, Matthew 10, verse 1, this is whenever Jesus had sent out his apostles earlier. He says in 10:1, Jesus called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and affliction. They had the ability. And he told them in 10:8, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. They had done this. And then even when they came back, they were amazed that they had had this ability to even cast out demons. But then, here's a child who is sick. And who is going to heal this child? Who is going to have mercy on this child? Now, Kirby, read 17:15 again for me.
Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and is very ill, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water.
Okay. Kirby, you use New King James or an ASB, which one?
Yeah, New American Standard.
ASB. I love this translation of that verse. The ESB calls him an epileptic, which is a guess. This is part of what we would call it in our vernacular. But NASB calls him a lunatic, which is actually how the Greek reads. Does anybody know why? This is just a trivia for the day. Why is he called a lunatic?
It was an evening condition.
Luna, which means?
Moon. Night or moon.
Moon, right? A lunatic is one who would be crazy when the moon comes out. So here you have this boy who, possessed by a demon, suffering terribly, and is even afflicting himself. It's interesting in Mark's account of this. Mark attributes this to the demon causing him to do it. Matthew is attributing this to the son himself. He falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him. Who is going to heal this son? Who is going to heal the child? Charlene, was there something you want to add?
I look in my Bible, it says that it's moonstruck.
Moonstruck. Yes. Moonstruck, yeah. Luna, yeah, moonstruck. And it's an excellent translation of that. Now, verse 16, Dorothy called me this afternoon to ask whether or not Peter, James, and John were among the disciples. That's a complicated question. Here's my answer to that. I don't think at the time when the Father came to them, Peter, James, and John were among the disciples. But the reason I worded the question in the way I did was, we also need to see Peter, James, and John are still in this group. Their faith is still weak. Even having experienced the glorified Lord, their faith is still weak. So here you have the question. I brought him to your disciples, and I'm going to put my own translation in here. They were unable to heal him, okay? Our English translations do not do a very good job about retaining this. But in Greek, you have this word unable, which literally means powerless. And this word is repeated in chapter 17, verse 16, 19, and then in 21. And I think this is the key word of this section. Let me show you this. Chapter 17, 16. I brought him to your disciples. They were unable to heal him. Verse 19. The disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why were we unable to cast it out? And then verse 21, or verse 20. Move from here and say to this mountain, nothing will be unable for you. That's the exact same word used in each of those cases. Our English translations just don't retain that very well. But this is the question then. Who can heal this son? Now, Jesus certainly could, but the disciples should have been able to. All of the disciples to whom Jesus had granted the Spirit should have been able to do this. But verse 16, I brought him to your disciples and they were unable to heal him. Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. Now, which Old Testament figure does that remind you of, these words? O faithless and twisted generation, Moses. How long will I be with you? Yeah, there you go, Kirby. This is Moses. This is Moses. If you look back to Deuteronomy 32:5, Deuteronomy 32:8, those exact words, or equivalents, I should say, are used of Moses in talking about Israel.
So there's one other. I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead,
so,
go ahead.
So that makes me think about what Dorothy asked you. So, you know, because I did some reading, and one of the comparisons was, you know, Jesus up on the mountain, you know, the transfiguration happens. He comes back down, and then his disciples can't heal this person. The same thing, you know, Moses goes up the mountain. He comes back down. They've got a golden calf. So I was curious, too, if those guys were with the rest of the disciples also, or they were just dumped into that whole brood.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's both. I think if you look at the chronology, Peter, James, and John were with Christ. But if you look at Matthew's reading of this, all the disciples still are lacking faith. Every last one of them. And even with the golden calf, Aaron is going to be the one who is going to be responsible for that. Horrendous. There's one other Old Testament figure who talks like this. How long am I to be with you? How long shall I bear you? Which figure in the Old Testament talks like that?
Elijah.
Is it Jeremiah? Is it Jeremiah?
Think of somebody far greater. Think of somebody far greater.
God.
Yeah, trick question. That's kind of a trick question. But God, if you go back and you look like at Numbers 14, 12 through 14, etc., that's the biggest rebellion in the book of Numbers. God is asking, how long shall I bear with you? How long shall I be with you? Now you have Jesus, the glorified Son of God, asking, how long shall I bear with you? How long shall I bear with you? Now, let's take this very personally. How long shall our God forbear the rebellion of his creation? How long will our Creator bear with the rebellions of his children? That's the question this text is asking us. We who lack faith, we who are powerless against the evil one, we who often are powerless against the prince of the power of the air, we who are unable to overcome the evil one, how long will God bear with us? Practically, I think that's what this text is wanting us to ask. How long will God bear with us when we are powerless over the evil one? There's the question. But then verse 18, Jesus rebuked the demon. And it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. How long will God bear with the children of Adam? How long will God forbear us? What's the answer?
As long as it takes to reach the promised land, I guess.
Boom. As long as it takes to reach the promised land.
Yeah.
Because he has intervened. God has taken our punishment and our rebellion, and he's come right in the middle of it. And he said, I will rebuke the demon. I will rebuke the evil one. Because with God, all things are able. Pete, go ahead.
I was just going to add to what Eric said, and as long as it takes for each of us to hear him and to see his glory, you know, think about the transfiguration that just talked about, and we're told to see who Jesus is and to hear him. And then when we're able to see that and comprehend that, we then recognize ourselves as this epileptic or lunatic son that's in need of the Lord to come into our lives, to heal us, to take us, to take the demon out of us, to take us into the kingdom of righteousness. So it's about two kingdoms or two dominions here as well that this is talking about.
Powerful, isn't it? It's powerful. I mean, when you notice that this narrative is reading each of us right into it, this is powerful. And honestly, I found this narrative so refreshing because Jesus hasn't done as many miracles like this since Matthew 8 through 10. So whenever we got back into this one, I was reading it this afternoon. I was like, man, this feels so powering because we know Christ is able to do this. He's healed Jairus' daughter and he'll summon many people. But now the Son of God himself is coming in to rebuke the evil one. This is what the narrative's about. With God, all things are able. But with man, this is not able. We are powerless. God is able. That's what this text is urging us to see. The disciples came to Jesus privately. I kind of get a kick out of that. Like the shame that they had to have felt. And they go to him privately. I love that Matthew puts that in. The disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here and there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Now, we know by this time in our study, y'all, we've been in Matthew 12 months now, we know by this time, Jesus says many things that simply don't make sense. I would put this right at the top of the list of things that do not make sense. Why does his answer on the surface not make any sense? Randy, go ahead, Randy.
Oh, I think so many have tied into, you know, we ought to be able to even move physical things with just speaking the name of Jesus, just invoking the power of Jesus Christ at that thing and having it out of our way or out of our life, even physical things to happen. And I've never read that into here, but I was not sure exactly why a mustard seed and a mountain are tied together.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yes.
And I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you're going to talk about it because that verse has been used a million times. But come on, Kirby, you don't have faith. You should be able to move a mountain. It's okay. That's right. That's what the verse says. You know, and, yeah, I'm sorry. You're my fault. And you know, I've heard it from the pulpit a bunch of times.
Just have faith. This is one of the passages that's abused. Hey, let me get Eric first, then come right back to you. Go ahead, Eric.
I was just gonna say it seems out of place to me because like following the story of the transfiguration and seeing, you know, the glory of the Son of God revealed that Jesus still sees that they have no faith.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't know. It seems odd, too, that they're so focused on themselves. Like, why could we not cast it out when faith is dependent on God, not on power?
This is where I think the text is leading us. Pete.
Yeah, same vein of thought. Zechariah 4. You know, it's not by their own power. It never will be by theirs or ours. It's only by the power of the Spirit working in us.
Exactly.
And a mustard seed in a mountain can have anything to do with each other.
Okay. So he talked through this with me for a second. If you look back at verse 20, are we to have the faith of a mustard seed or the faith of a mountain?
He says the mustard seed.
And would you call faith of a mustard, the faith of a mustard seed, would you call the faith of a mustard seed big faith or little faith? Compared to a mountain.
Well, little in the size comparison, but perhaps big in the thought of what the power that the mustard seed can do and accomplish.
This is the irony of the text to me. Okay. Now, this to me, y'all, is the irony of the text. Let me read this in my own version. This is my take on it. The disciples said to Jesus, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have little faith, you will say to this mountain, move, and this big thing will move." So the problem is little faith. The solution is little faith.
I got it.
Somebody explain that to me, please.
I got it.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, you know, you just talked about they came to him privately and asked him why they couldn't do it. It makes me think about in high school, in a mathematics class, when the teacher asks me the answer to this problem and I give her the wrong answer and I'm embarrassed in front of the class. So after class, I go to her privately and say, "How did I miss that? What did I do wrong? I need to figure this out so that I don't make the same mistake again." And the problem we've already addressed, the disciples are doing that. What technically did we not do? Did we not tilt our head to the left? Did we not hold our hands over the guy? And Jesus says, that's not it. You think it's a little thing. It is a little thing, but it's a little faith. You have to have a little faith, not a little technique.
Boom. Now, let's talk through this. Now, this is the paradox here. Now, Bruce is getting us in the right direction here. The problem of this text is little faith. The solution of this text is little faith. Put that together.
So then does it depend on the source of that faith? I have little faith in myself, it's not going to matter. But if my little faith is in God and in the power of the Spirit, that makes all the difference.
Boom, boom, boom. And I think, Bruce, that's exactly what you were saying. You gave us an illustration. He just came out and said it. Okay.
I like Steve and Karen's comment, you know, Luke 1:37.
Yes.
With God, all things are possible.
Yes.
How true.
Yes. Let's talk through this for a minute. Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of a mustard seed, which we've seen that parable before in Matthew, you will say to this mountain, "Move from here to there," and you will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Now, I want to work through this backward, actually. Where do we read in the Old Testament about the moving of mountains? A couple of very important places. Start back in Zechariah chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4. I gave a sermon on Zechariah 4 probably a couple of years ago now. I love this chapter. This is one of the chapters of the Old Testament that's just so neglected because it's so powerful.
When you were going through all the kings and when that
was. No, that this was right after the Revelation study, Kirby. For those of y'all that weren't in that study, Revelation in the New Testament is pretty much a New Testament version of the book of Zechariah. So we went back and studied through Zechariah, but that's been a while now. Read Heath for me, Zechariah 4, verse 6 and verse 7.
So he answered and said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace, grace to it.
Oh, this is a great chapter. Zerubbabel, who was the chief official in charge of rebuilding the temple, has reached a stalemate. He's just not building anymore. Yahweh then sends Zechariah and Haggai to him and tells him, get back to work. It's time to build. Haggai and Zechariah preach. They get it done. And this, to me, is the key of what both prophets tell them. Not by might, nor by power. I'm going to put this in my own words. Not by mighty things that you may do, but by the small trust in my spirit. And when you have faith by my spirit and in my spirit, you shall say to this mountain, move. And this mountain will become a plain. Now, one other place. This one's really, really important as well. Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40 talks about the moving of mountains. Look at Isaiah 40. Now, this is cool. Heed Isaiah 40, verses 3 through 5.
The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken.
Now, this is a beautiful text. Because from the New Testament revelation, we know who is the voice who was crying in the wilderness?
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist. John the Baptist is crying out, every mountain and hill shall be made low. You will move mountains. But let me ask this. Whenever Jesus Christ was on the earth, talk to this with me for a second. When Jesus Christ was on the earth, did he take Mount Sinai and move it over here?
No.
Now, this is like Sazed. did he like take mountains literally and move it?
No.
What does it mean that the servant would move mountains?
I think he means it was he will change hearts and change minds.
Yes. He was going to change the very fabric of this world. But how was he going to do it? He was going to do it not by changing everything outside us. He was going to change everything inside of us. What does it mean back in Matthew 17, 20, then Heath, to move mountains? Bruce, go ahead. I can see you're going right where I'm wanting to go.
You just gave me the answer to 21. I've been trying to figure that out all my life, and I just got it tonight. So that's great. So. In verse 20, move mountains, it means break down what I thought was important and find out what's really important.
Yes.
That's what moving mountains is.
Power or might, but
not by mind. When my spirit is awakened, when I really fully realize to connect back that I am made in the image of God and I should be acting like that.
Exactly. And you ought to move mountains means that our very hearts, that's it. Thank you, Carrie. Our very hearts can be reshaped by the cosmic geography of God. look at that Luke 1 chapter real quick. I wasn't planning on going here tonight, but I love this verse. Notice the whole context of this. Luke 1:34. Mary said to the angel, how will this be since I'm a virgin? The angel answered her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, a child shall be born to you, holy, the Son of God. And behold, your relative Elizabeth in her old age has conceived a son. And this 6 months with her was even when she was barren. Nothing is impossible with God. Mary said, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. And the angel departed from her. What does this mean? Y'all, give me 10 more minutes. I'm going to have to go over tonight because we have to get through this text. What does this mean? Whenever you think through Father, have more space to write. Whenever you think through the, let me erase this real quick because I really want to visualize this. Whenever you notice what's going on in Isaiah 40, Zechariah 4, Luke 1, and also this phrase is used in Matthew 19 as well, with God all things are able. The idea is that the mountain is going to become a valley. And the valley is going to become a mountain. What does that mean? It means that the things that this world considers mighty and great will be small things in the kingdom of God. And the things that this world deems small, God is counting mighty. Mountains will be moved. And literally what the Son of God did was enter into the wreck of this world and exalt not the powerful and the rich and the authorities and the rulers, but he exalted the humble and the lowly and the sick and the outcast. And through the Spirit of God, the lowly have been made mighty and the mighty have been made lowly. Using the words of Luke 14, the humble have been exalted and the exalted have been humbled. To put all this a different way, I read this somewhere and absolutely love this. What does it, little faith mean? It means that faith's power does not equal faith's quantity. Okay? What that means is faith's power does not equal faith's quantity. What do I mean by that? The way that I think this passage is often interpreted is exactly what Kirby just said. If you're struggling with something or if you are encountering a difficulty, just have more faith and it'll fix itself. I can remember very vividly talking to a lady at Lafayette who she and her husband were going through immense financial difficulty. And she said, Ryan, I finally figured out what I need to do. I just need greater faith. No, no, no. That ain't it. No. You're assuming that faith's quantity is going to yield faith's power. What does that mean for the disciples? If that's true, have more faith in your abilities to heal, and then your great abilities to heal will do great things. Jesus says the exact opposite of this. You need little faith. You need little faith, faith like a mustard seed, meaning that you do not trust in yourself, but put a little bit of your faith in God. And that little bit of faith is not only going to grow like a mustard seed, but it will do powerful things that will even move mountains. And then with that said, when I come to the Bible, Jesus says, oh, I don't have time to talk about verse 21 in detail. Let me just say this briefly. This is a textual variance. Some translations include verse 21. Some don't. I really like it included in here simply because Mark says something very, very, very similar. This is the stuff Tom Hamilton taught us about textual variances. I think it complements what Jesus is saying perfectly. What you need is prayer and fasting. It's not about you yourself becoming great and mighty, but it's in prayer, humbly listening to God. And if you take this full circle, what Matthew 17 has really been showing us, Matthew 17, 1 through 13 is all about listen to him. Matthew 17, 14 through 21 is all about talk to him. Both of those are held together there. But now, with all of that said, if you have little faith, Mountains will be moved. Valleys will become mountains. God will work wondrous things. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. And they will kill him. And he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. Oh, they still don't get it. Bruce, I'm going to be hard on them again for 1 minute here. They still don't get it. Because what should they have understood? They should have understood that the Son of Man is about to be handed into the hands of men. See the paradox there? The Son is about to be handed into the hands of men. The Son of Man is going to be handed over. And he's going to become a valley. He will be rejected and persecuted and killed. And yet, from the apparent powerlessness and inability and end of the cross, God is going to bring about a whole new race, a new creation. Those who are in the second Adam. The valley will be made a mountain. And what do we need? Little faith. That powerful.
They forgot to listen to the very end where it said, and he will be raised, you know, the resurrection.
Yeah. And they couldn't get past that first part where how in the world could this Messiah, the Son of God, the one who is the author of life, enter into death? But the valley will be made a hill and a mountain. With God, all things are possible. Okay. What are y'all's thoughts before we close tonight?
Well, we talked a bit about giving the disciples a hard time. And I think of how many years I have studied the word, the words of Jesus, and still glean these things that should have been evident. And they only had 3.5 years. So, and they didn't have it in writing where they could just keep going back to it and back to it. But still, it seems like it would have been more profound to them in person. But Jesus shows us that they didn't get it. It helps us to feel more human and more accepted that we're getting it slowly, like they seem to be getting it slowly.
Absolutely. And Randy, what do we need?
We need the faith of God. We don't need to rely on ourselves.
Little faith. Pete, go ahead.
I'm going back to this idea of their expectation from the prophecies of Elijah. I'm sure that was confounding to them. If you go back to verse 11, Jesus told them, yeah, Elijah's coming first and he's going to restore all things. And I think there was a disconnect in their mind to what they expected the restoration to be like and what it really was. They didn't expect the Son of Man to be crucified and be killed. They expected, based on what Isaiah said, or Elijah rather, there's going to be a restoration. So I think that probably was part of their difficulty in understanding.
They simply wanted the glorification without the rejection. They wanted the exaltation without the humiliation. Jesus is telling them, that's not how my kingdom's going to work. I'm going to take the small things and make them mighty things, and the mighty things will be small things. The humiliated things will be exalted. The exalted things will be humiliated. The great things will become powerless, and powerless will become great. Such is the nature of the kingdom of God.
And all those disciples that sometimes you say we give a hard time to, they all held true, man. Judas didn't, but every other one of them held true. You know, which is what hopefully, prayerfully, I will do and the rest of us will do.
Absolutely.
And the cross shows that this new life can only come through death.
Yes. It is with much tribulations that we must enter into the kingdom of God. Yeah. Eric?
Do you think that's what Paul is teaching in 1 Corinthians 13 when he says, you know, if you have all faith as to remove mountains but don't have love,
yes,
you don't have anything?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. In 1 Corinthians 13, I mean, yeah, totally. It is. It's all about they have started. Okay, Randy, I'll be ready for you right after this last comment, okay? But, oh, I could go for another hour tonight, y'all. I love this. Is such a great text. 1 Corinthians 13 is the exact apostolic application of what's going on here. Chapter 12, they have been granted gifts of the Spirit, and they're now thinking, oh, how wondrous we are. We can talk in other tongues. We can prophesy. We have revelations. Look how mighty we are. The Apostle Paul tells them, but if you have not love, meaning if you do not have a life that is willing to suffer for another, if you do not have a life that is willing to be laid down for another, if you do not have love, you have nothing. You need the faith of a mountain. It's not just paradoxical, but the heavenly wisdom of God's people. Let us have a little faith. All right. Y'all, thank you for being patient tonight. This is just such a rich text. I didn't want to cut out this last part and see how the cross brings all this together. But Randy, I will turn it over to you.